Welcome and thank you very much for joining us for episode 178 of the Blazers Edge podcast presented to you today by BlazersEdge.com. I'm your weekend host, Chris Lucia.
And I am your weekend co-host, Brandon Goldner. If you want to reach out to the Blazers Edge weekend podcast, you can always write us at BlazersEdgePodcast@gmail.com. And please, for the love of everything, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Stitcher, iTunes, Instagram, and on the site, and we would love to see your ratings, reviews, and subscriptions, because anything you say will be promptly ignored by us.
Joining us this week on the Blazers Edge Weekend Podcast is writer for The Sporting News, The Athletic, also podcast host of Locked On Warriors, co-host of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, and host of Real GM Radio, Danny LaRue. Danny, thanks for coming on the show this week.
Thanks, and apologies for making you spit out that whole long intro, but it's the way it goes.
No, you bet, man. We're definitely happy to talk about the things you're doing, and you're a national NBA writer, and as we mentioned earlier, you're on so many different outlets, and you know, on a night like tonight, when the Blazers are putting on a preseason game against the Los Angeles Clippers, we want to thank you very much for, putting off NBA preseason basketball to talk to us on the Blazers Edge Weekend podcast, man.
It's preseason basketball. It's not the biggest thing in the world, but it's still interesting all the same.
Although you wouldn't know it if you follow the Blazers social media, made a pretty big deal of the fact that they're 3-0 in preseason and haven't done that in like 20 years. So I guess some people take it more seriously than others.
Yeah. I mean, especially when it's your job to get people excited, then if you have something that can excite them, by all means.
So what are your thoughts, Danny, on preseason in general? Is it, in your opinion, is it too long? Could they cut it down? What's your take on that?
I defer more to the coaches and the players in terms of that. And for the limited amount that I've talked with them about it, they think there should be fewer games, and maybe the amount of practices is fine because they can have more control over that. You know, if it's a long day or a short day, they can adjust that. And with games, it can be a challenge, but at the same time, they can manufacture and massage it a little bit by just playing guys that are lower on the bench, because fortunately the NBA allows you to have 20 if you want to at this point. Yeah. So they can go into that. But if you're dealing with fan satisfaction, and a lot of these games, at least for the Warriors, but I think it's true overall, are played in atypical places, then you do feel a sort of obligation to making sure that you satisfy everybody with the experience.
Something that the Blazers used to do that I always thought was really cool was that they would travel down to, you know, like Eugene, for instance, and put on a preseason game at MacArthur Court where the Oregon Ducks played, or they would go to like Central Oregon, I think, one time, and they played, you know, a game a few hours away from Portland in a different arena in the state, just to kind of gather interest from fans throughout the state. Is that something that the Warriors do as well? You mentioned that it was them getting into different arenas and things.
They are this year. So they played a game already in San Jose, which is kind of on the south end of the Bay Area. They're also playing the Lakers in San Diego. And I think they're playing the Lakers in Vegas as well. And while Vegas is not California, it's close enough that a lot of California people go to stuff there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they are doing a little bit of that barnstorming. They're actually only playing 2 games at Oracle. I think they play 7 preseason games. So that's, you know, that's a way to do it. And it does align in some ways more with NBA history. You know, when teams, they used to actually kind of barnstorm a little bit during the year, like Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game was in Hershey, those types of things. And there is a certain kind of outreach there that can be good. And they're also doing all the international games is nice, too.
Well, I just want to give a shout out to myself, because one of the very first Blazers, I know, always a good thing to do, shout out to yourself. One of the first games I ever caught was in Corvallis at Oregon State University. But before we get into Blazers stuff, Danny, I wanted to ask, you've been credentialed to write about the Golden State Warriors since 2009. So, I mean, you've seen that team transition from a 26-win team to the end of the second Don Nelson era to a mediocre team, to one of the best and maybe the best team in the history of the league. What is that like for you as a writer to see the team that you cover so closely go through such a drastic transition?
It's surreal, because they were, for my entire basically childhood and early adulthood, they were not only a bad team for the most part, but they were a bad organization. And so that was the Chris Kohan era in particular. There were a lot of famous failures. You can think about, people loved Run TMC. They were only together for like a year and a half. Like, there were all these kind of short-lived fun teams, the We Believe Warriors, only made the playoffs once. And so to kind of step into it at that point, my first game was Steph Curry's first game at Oracle, to then see the change, not only, you know, I think I've been through three coaching changes and one ownership change, but also to see this fan base that had been so downtrodden, that had been beaten down, but still amazing and enthusiastic, get a team that was actually worth cheering for, was in some ways a bigger part of it than anything else. But of course, being there when I started, there were only about 7 or 8 people that were really there every game, to the just massive humanity they have now, is also a change. And I'm really thankful I got in early, because I got to have that experience cutting my teeth, where there weren't as many, there were really supportive people like Sam Amick and Marcus Thompson and Mark Spears. But, you know, like, it was great to have that. But to be able to experience it, to appreciate this for all the insanity that it is quite fun.
So you mentioned, Danny, a handful of historical Warriors teams, Run TMC being that one that stands out the most to me. I think I want to ask you, did you play NBA Jam back in the day?
Absolutely. I still play it. I had an emulator to play it a few years ago. They actually re-released, I think, I can't remember who owns the rights now, they re-released it with current players a couple of years ago, and I played it then too.
Dude, so I will still contend to this day that the best team, and I'm talking about NBA Jam original, not necessarily tournament edition, is the Golden State Warriors, because you have LaPhonso Ellis and Latrell Sprewell. Like, that's a ton of versatility. Both guys can get to they have full dunks. They could both shoot from outside, and they're both decent defenders in that game. What do you think about that?
They weren't my team. You guys are going to get a kick out of this. So the year before I started covering the Warriors, I was in law school, and I got like one of those 4-game ticket packages way up top, just because I wanted to see a couple teams. I think the main one I wanted to see was the Cavs and LeBron. And I did that. And up top at that time, they since pulled it. They had an NBA Jam machine. And my team was always the Pacers, because I thought Reggie Miller was just a monster in that game. And you had Reggie Miller and Rick Smits. And so those were my guys. But the Warriors were a very good team in that. They just weren't my favorite.
So transitioning back to 2016-2017 NBA basketball, on the Dunked On podcast that you co-host with Nate Duncan, fairly famously, I would say, this summer at Blazers Edge, at least, it was quite the topic of conversation when you guys were doing your off-season review and got to the Blazers. Nate Duncan was pretty, I would say, pretty lukewarm at best on the Blazers moves. But when he was on the podcast, he mentioned that you were even further down on the Blazers. And I think it was an F- grade that they got.
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenging thing to explain, because I'm such a big fan of Portland's organization from the top down. Olshay's done a great job. Big believer in Terry Stotts, been a fan of Damian Lillard for a long time. And the problem for me was that they had this very narrow window with which to make real spending, to make these big decisions. And they did so, you know, and they swung big and missed. You know, they tried to get Chandler Parsons. They tried to get Hassan Whiteside. And I'm never going to blame them for that, because it happens. But my feeling was that Evan Turner is a talented basketball player who did not fill the needs that they had. And they really had one shot at becoming a great team, and they didn't really use it. And so some of that is, you know, is bad luck. Some of it is just that they settled. I think that was the biggest flaw that I had with it. And they did a nice job getting Festus Ezeli. I'm a little bit of a homer with him, not because I covered him, but also because I know him a little bit and really like him. But when you're thinking about setting the table for 3, 4, 5 years, I'm not a believer that Evan Turner really does that for them.
So in a way, you're saying the Blazers kind of pushed all their chips to the center of the table around the core of players that they had last year, plus the addition of Evan Turner?
Right. And so they had this amazing opportunity for Dunked On. We did that mock off season. I actually didn't have the Blazers. Kevin Pelton did. And through that process, I thought a lot about, you know, wow, this is a team that made the second round last year, that was phenomenal, and actually had space to really make a difference. And they have young guys that are really talented. And it felt like it didn't work out in that way. And then the other crazy part, and this could end up working itself out, is while I understand the desire to retain everybody else, they have this crazy circumstance now where their team is really expensive, and if Paul Allen pays it, that's fine. But I have seen in you know, covering the NBA for years, is that when you have a team that's really, really expensive, usually that leads to them making decisions eventually that end up hurting the quality of the team. And the most prominent example of this is Miami using the amnesty on Mike Miller. You know, even though they were making, presumably making a ton of money, won two championships, they did that. And that's when teams make mistakes. And so I'm hopeful that the Blazers won't do that. I root for the best for every team, especially a team I like. But I've seen that movie before, and it concerns me whenever it happens. The Nets are another example of that.
So as you said, the Blazers struck out with Chandler Parsons, struck out with Hassan Whiteside. In your view, after those moves didn't work out, was the Blazers offseason more or less doomed, or are there one or two different scenarios that maybe you would have preferred to see played out after they had kind of a swing and a miss with those free agents?
Well, so you're definitely dealing with imperfect solutions. I would have liked Jan Mahinmi there. He also has a connection with Terry Stotts because of their time in Dallas, and that would have been good. I'm more of a Bismack Biyombo believer than most. He also theoretically might have taken a little bit less money to play on a team that was more put together, which is what Festus did, and a few other people. So those kinds of things. But there is really a good point to the idea that having another guy who can run the offense, who's capable with the ball in their hands, was something they needed. And the truth of the matter, especially, you know, after a few days of free agency, is that most of those players were gone. But, you know, like there are a series of other imperfect players that would have been better. And that gets into kind of my issue with Evan Turner on the Blazers, which is that he is a rarity in that he is a player who defends a position other than point guards who can run an offense. He did an admirable job for the Celtics last year. However, he is among that group. He is one of those guys who is who has a great gap between when he has the ball in his hands and when he doesn't. And that means that let's say he's playing with Damian Lillard. Lillard is great with the ball in his hands. He's also good without it. But you don't want to take possessions away from Lillard to give them to Turner, because that's downgrading. It's the same issue the Warriors have dealt with at various moments in time. And so it's a little bit different with CJ. And so, you know, like, I actually thought Evan Turner was a decent fit on the team in a smaller role and with a smaller paycheck, but that isn't what happened.
So I feel like the sentiment, excuse me, among Portland fans and people who follow the Blazers, ever since, you know, the summer of 2015, Wesley Matthews, LaMarcus Aldridge, Nick Batum, Robin Lopez, everybody leaving town, bringing in that new nucleus of talent around Damian Lillard last offseason, a lot of people, you know, Vegas expected 26.5 wins or something. They far exceeded just about everybody in the entire world's expectations by winning 44 wins last season. And so with people who follow the Blazers, I think there's a sentiment that it wasn't necessarily overachieving, because, you know, they did click at one point in the season, and they were on pace, you know, for a very good record despite, you know, somewhat of a slow start. So I think the sentiment there is that the Blazers maybe didn't necessarily overachieve. It's just that they all got better, and they got better together, and they all kind of raised the baseline in terms of their level of play. And so if we're looking at season previews for this year, it seems like a number of national outlets seem to think that the Blazers are a candidate to, quote unquote, maybe slide back or underperform a little bit, or not, you know, exceed expectations the way they did last season. So in your eyes, Danny, do you think the Blazers, you know, there's a legitimate claim to be made that, you know, around Damian Lillard, this is actually a legit team, and they weren't just playing over their heads for, you know, 40, 50 games last season?
My answer is kind of both. So they didn't really overachieve that much. That has been overstated. It was more a misevaluation of talent than that they overperformed it. Guys like CJ McCollum took a big step up, but he's a good basketball player. That's what we learned. We didn't know that. We know that now in a way that we didn't before. The part of it that goes the other way, though, is that they were fortunate in a couple of different ways, but the most notable ones are health. They were a very healthy team last year. Not perfect. No team is perfect in terms of health, but they were pretty healthy compared to especially a lot of the teams in the middle of the West that just fell apart. Memphis is the most obvious example. Dallas with Chandler Parsons, who we talked about a little bit earlier. You know, those types of teams. And that's the other way that Portland benefited a little bit. And I don't think this is a big deal, but they had a couple of games that were good fortune in terms of just getting teams at the right times. You know, they faced some of those teams after guys got hurt as opposed to before. And so that all fits together with an idea that last year was a pretty good calibrator, but there is always a degree of variance within that. So, you know, let's say that you thought they were a 42 or a 44 win team last year. Well, even if they brought back the same guys and everything else, there would be a variance of that, maybe from 50 to 40 or 41, and you know, something in that range. And that's fair. And the challenge with Portland, and I'd be interested to hear what you guys think of it. My concern, if you want to call it that, is their biggest flaw last year was defense. And Terry Stotts did a great job getting Al-Farouq Aminu at the four. I thought they looked a lot better with that. But if you consider that their biggest flaw, and if you're concerned about Festus Ezeli actually being able to be on the court, as it looks like is an issue right now, it's hard to think about how they'll be substantially better on that end. They could be a little bit better, but being substantially better. And when you talk about outperforming expectations, really you need that kind of a step, assuming that you don't, like, this team had such great chemistry and the guys played so well that you don't expect those sorts of improvements, because when you're already at, like, if you want to use basketball video game terminology like we did before, if your chemistry is already at 100, you can't really get to 105. So you have to work within what you have. And so we'll see how that works. But finding out how they're going to improve, particularly defensively, I would love to be wrong. But at this point, it seems like it's a harder sell.
Well, let me throw out a possibility in how the Blazers could improve their defense a little bit, because you think about their players, and yes, they did have good chemistry, and yes, they did work well together. But you think about an addition like Evan Turner, maybe a little bit overrated defender, that's fair. But CJ McCollum, you know, it was his first year starting, right? Alan Crabb, it was his first year getting significant minutes. Mason Plumlee, if I'm not mistaken, it was his first year being a consistent starter, where he was packed behind Brook Lopez in Brooklyn. And so I wonder, just to turn the question back on you, do you think that because the Blazers have another year under their belt, because they have another year in the system, because some of these guys either were not starters before or they didn't get significant rotation minutes before, do you think that there is some modicum of improvement that could be found just by playing tighter and better defense as a team?
Sure. It is also worth noting that while they didn't have those roles before, these aren't guys who are really new to the NBA in that sense. So, you know, it isn't like, let's say, Minnesota, where Minnesota was horrendous last year defensively in a way that they shouldn't have been. But with their whole coaching thing and the fact that basically everybody on their team was in their first or second year, that's a bigger adjustment than going from being a role player to being a starter. So like Mason Plumlee, you know, he's going to be in his last year. He was in his third year last year. He's going to be in his fourth this year. And he was a rotation guy for the Nets. So it wasn't like he was just sitting on the bench the whole time. So that is a partial part of improvement. The bigger argument that I would make is that they didn't reach their like what looks like they're going to be the analogy of their starting lineup, you know, with Aminu at the four until late in the year. And so there is more potential in terms of communication and expectations and everything like that with those guys together than they had before. So you can talk about how that kind of improvement can happen. And that's something, you know, watching the league, that guys, once they learn where other people want to be and their best roles, they can improve even if the players have played together just as a five-man unit.
So I'll go back to a few seasons when Terry Stotts was hired to take over the Blazers, and he had a young Damian Lillard and, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge and a handful of other guys in their primes. And that first season, you saw, you know, a pretty efficient offense, and that was installed, and it seemed to go pretty well that season. And then the next year, they maintained that solid offense and also improved the defense. And I feel like, you know, that's kind of something that Terry Stotts maybe does with his teams, especially when he has young teams, is that he doesn't overload them. And I feel like if you look at the Blazers last year, you know, that offense, that's a top 10 offense in terms of offensive rating in the NBA. The defense was lagging quite a bit behind, but we saw that improvement in the next season and Stotts' first iteration, the first year he was coaching the Blazers. You saw that year-over-year improvement where the offense improved first and then the defense improved. And now he had to start over with several different players. And I feel like this may be kind of the process starting again. So You know, me personally, and I guess a lot of this rests on the health of a guy like Festus Ezeli and the development of a guy like Myers Leonard, but me personally, I'm pretty optimistic about Terry Stotts and putting in, making the defensive concepts this year a little bit more complex after, you know, the players have gotten down the offense last season.
Yeah, I think there's a good case, and there is a little bit of precedent. The issue that you run into with teams like this at a certain point, and they might not be there yet, they might be able to jump, let's say, 5-6 places based on that sort of improvement, is just the idea of physical capability. I'm somebody who's a big believer in the idea of having a rim protector and center defense, just because they can clean up so many mistakes. And you can point around the league, and a lot of the best teams defensively, Spurs with Tim Duncan, Grizzlies with a healthy Marc Gasol, have that. And teams can succeed in other ways. Charlotte is the most prominent example. Charlotte has had a very good defense the last couple of years, starting Al Jefferson at center and Cody Zeller. And so you can do it, but it requires a system and a lot of effort and things like that. And Portland's so good offensively, I can understand why you don't want to ask your players to do what might be necessary there. And it's a lot of scheme stuff. So the question for them is just really, where is their ceiling physically and all that kind of stuff? And it could be higher than I think. But, you know, a big part of doing this as long as I have is that you have to be ready to be wrong, and you want to be optimistic about everybody. But that's also why Ezeli is so important, is because Ezeli has a really high defensive ceiling. You know, he's a solid rim protector. He can be a very good rebounder. And he still has room to grow, because he's missed so much time over his 4 years in the NBA due to injuries. And he can do different things. He has limitations offensively, which I have experienced, and you guys will experience this year. But you have to you take that for the center. And so Portland has a lot of different guys they can throw at that question, and there are also always downsides. I mean, Plumlee is a wonderful pick and roll guy. He's one of the few roll guys in the league who you can pass him the ball. He can make two dribbles and a good decision. You know, that's the line that I use for guys capable. He can do that, and almost anybody else they're going to play at the five can't do that. And so you have to make those sort of trade-offs, and we'll see how it works out.
So you mentioned the Hornets and the defense that Clifford over there has put in, and he's been able to squeeze out a pretty effective defense, like you mentioned, with guys like Zeller starting and Al Jefferson starting at center. I mean, to me, that seems completely counterintuitive, guys like that, and having, you know, I would say, you know, being recognized as one of the, you know, better defensive teams in the NBA, at least. All things considered there in terms of personnel. So getting back to that scheme that Steve Clifford put in Charlotte, you know, to maximize the talents of the players that he did have available, let's assume that Festus Ezeli is only good for, you know, 55, 60 games this year, and maybe 15, 20, that might be pushing it, minutes a night, depends. And maybe Myers Leonard isn't, you know, doesn't take that next step as a rim protector. So let's assume that we're kind of looking at Mason Plumlee, Ed Davis, guys like that playing a bulk of the minutes at center for the Blazers, not guys who are known as rim protectors. Is there anything from those schemes that Clifford has installed in Charlotte that Terry Stotts, you know, could take to maybe get the best out of the players that he has available to him?
Yeah, I think that one of the aspects that Charlotte uses a lot is kind of trying to minimize dribble penetration, and the idea of trying to put players, you know, like even when you know there are going to be seams in any defense, but trying to put those in the places where they're least destructive is a good mindset to have for any team, but it's especially true when you don't have that center. And one of the biggest examples I can think of with this is going back to that Clippers series before Chris Paul got hurt. The Clippers knew that they wanted to get Lillard onto Chris Paul. And so what they were doing is they were running a lot of these cursory kind of like handoffs things to try to generate a switch for the Blazers. And so to switch CJ, a lot of times it was a one and two handoff. So like Jamal Crawford or JJ Redick or whoever. And the Blazers were basically just letting them get what they wanted. And even if you eventually give that up, because it's just really hard to do, like if they're going to try that for 10 seconds, it's hard to, you know, stop it five times in a row. But making them work that 5 to 10 seconds is actually really valuable. We lose sight of that sometimes, but just making another team work for an extra few seconds with the shot clock being only 24 can really make it so that teams settle into some harder decisions than Portland forced them to last year. And that's an adjustment they can make this year without any problems.
How much faith do you have in the backcourt of Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum combining to allow the Blazers to, you know, potentially be an above average defense someday?
It's hard. You know, the challenge with them is twofold. One, they don't necessarily have the right, you know, physical things. They're super like long for their, I mean, Dame's a great athlete, but they don't really have that part of it. And CJ is more, CJ in a lot of ways would be better defensively as a one than a two, but you know, that's just the limitation there. But generally speaking, point guard defense is overrated. This is why I got mad at people on Twitter during the offseason about some people were like, oh, they should trade CJ. It's like, no, guard offense is substantially more important than guard defense. You can survive it. It's not a problem, but it just does make it a little bit harder. And that's what puts more onus on having a defensive center, having a, you know, hopefully Evan Turner can be the small forward they need defensively. Aminu has a lot of talent. So it puts more strain there and it does limit their ceiling a little bit, but it's broadly overrated in terms of the reason a defense fails.
So I know that we are a Blazers podcast and that's our MO, but you're a credentialed writer for the Golden State Warriors. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask Danny, how good is this Warriors team going to be this year? I'm looking at a team that could potentially win 75 games. I know that there is a lot to be said for maybe not wanting to push as hard as they can through the regular season. There's not going to be that same motivation to try to set the single season record for wins, but just how good do you think this Golden State Warriors team is going to be? And I know that you've seen a couple of preseason games. It's going to take a lot longer than that to get Kevin Durant comfortable. How good do you think they're going to be this season?
I wouldn't focus too much on regular season wins and losses because they're not. And, you know, that's one way of defining success for a team is how they define it themselves. But they could be the best offense people our age have ever seen. I think that's important to consider. And what that opens up for everything else is that, you know, if they can get to that kind of a level, they led the league in offensive rating last year. They led the league in effective field goal percentage offense last year, and they should be meaningfully better.
And again, this is kind of a hot takey kind of question, but I'm seriously curious. Do you think that there's a possibility that if they do save themselves the regular season, that they could pull off the 16-0 sweep in the playoffs?
It's possible. They will, you know, if they're at full strength or close to it, in my opinion, they should be the favorites in every single postseason game. And when you're the favorites in every game, that doesn't mean you'll win all of them, but you're the favorites in it. So my bold prediction, if you want to call it that, so far has been that I expect that they will win, that they will lose five or fewer games in the playoffs. But 16-0 is a possibility. But what you have to remember with things like that, and the Portland series is a great example, is that there is a lot of random variance and everything like that. And NBA teams are incredibly good. Almost every team that makes it as far as Portland did last year, as far as Cleveland winning the title, has players that can go off and just have those games. And 16-0 is, you know, it's kind of the idea is that you're avoiding those worst case scenarios every point. But why the Warriors are different is that some nights they're going to be able to survive another team's best shot. And that's different than a lot of other teams. You know, some nights, the example might be that game that Portland played in the regular season against the Warriors. I think it was the first game after the All-Star break where they were just on. That was Portland's, to me, the best regular season game I saw them play all year. And the Warriors just weren't going to beat them. This year, you know, if the Warriors can play their best guys and they're having good nights, they might be able to survive that.
So Festus Ezeli mentioned after he signed with the Blazers this summer that in that series you mentioned, he got a taste for what the Blazers were all about and their chemistry and their character, and in particular, the leadership of Damian Lillard, the coaching of Terry Stotts. He was, you know, came away, at least from what he publicly said, very impressed by the Portland Trailblazers. So I want to ask you, as somebody who covers the entire league and specifically the Golden State Warriors, did you come away thinking any differently of the Trailblazers after that second round series against the Warriors, even though they lost 3-1 or 4-1, I should say.
4-1. They showed a lot of heart and a lot of chemistry. I mean, even with Curry being not himself, the Warriors still have a lot of talent, and the Blazers just didn't have enough there to win that series, but they competed in every single game. And a lot of the stuff that they kind of like, a lot of those games were close and there were little things that could have swung the balance. And those are the types of things that you think, as we talked about a little bit earlier, that get better with time, that you start to figure those things out. If you want to call them not rookie mistakes, but young guy mistakes, that's just a part of this league. And so that was very encouraging. But the way that it really looked like they cared about each other, that they played really hard. And that Stotts, I think the world of him as a coach, just because he puts players in a good place to succeed. He puts them in the right situation. And that's really uncommon. You know, there aren't that many coaches who you think that if you gave them a random group of 15 guys and you said, build a system and give them a year to buy in and to figure everything out, that I would rather have than Terry Stotts. And that was true before the playoffs, but it really did solidify that.
Wow. So I'm actually kind of surprised by the sentiments about Terry Stotts. I knew nationally he had a solid reputation, but I am taken a little bit aback by how complimentary you are. Because if we're looking at the way Coach of the Year has, you know, shaken out the last several seasons, I think Terry Stotts was, you know, in our opinion, in Portland and people who follow the Blazers, you know, he should have been probably up there, you know, if not winning it. You know, you can't do that every year and it's not always realistic. And there's 29 other teams in the NBA that you're competing with, right? So, you know, it's not that he didn't get number one, but, you know, maybe getting consideration for second or third place. And that hasn't happened as consistently as we thought. So I'm wondering if Terry Stotts' reputation nationally is kind of beginning to catch up with, you know, what we've been talking about in regards to him in Portland for a long time.
I'm not representative in that way for a lot of different reasons, just because I kind of exist separately from a lot of that kind of stuff, as much as what we like to think that what Nate and I do is, you know, it sets a sort of tone. It is very different from a lot of the, you know, national outlets or things like that. But what you look at in terms of coaching, what I like to see is a team that outperforms their talent. And while there are questions about how much the Blazers did that last year, they certainly at least pushed to the edge of what those guys could do. And that's what you really look for in a coach. And yeah, I think I had him second or third. I don't remember this offhand because Pop did an amazing job with the Spurs last year. But Coach of the Year is a little bit different just because there are always these superlatives. And also something you look at, if you're at all concerned about that, look at all the coaches that have won that award and then gotten deservedly fired. And the reason for that is a lot of the reason a coach wins that award is because a team was unfairly underhyped, might be the best word for it. Like, they were under-evaluated. And so, wow, they overachieved expectations or they overachieved their prior year. Like, Sam Mitchell is probably a good example of this. You know, like, Sam Mitchell I'm not sure he's the worst coach in the league, but he's definitely not towards the top. But because I believe that was with Toronto, they won a bunch more games than the prior year. He won Coach of the Year. But you wouldn't sit there just like Pop. If you were saying who is the best coach, Popovich would win the award most years. And he's only won it, I think, once or twice. So that's not a big deal. But in terms of perception, yeah, it seems there. And his time in Portland is really helping Stotts because this team has done a great job, and all the stuff that you look for and attribute to a coach, they do well, except maybe defensively. But again, we've talked about how I think that a lot of that is just their structural flaws based on the guys they have on the court.
So I want to wrap here comparing, you know, we've already talked about the Warriors quite a bit, so we may as well wrap here talking about them a little more and maybe looking at the Warriors and the trajectory that they've had. You know, the last several seasons, you've seen them, as Brandon mentioned much earlier in the podcast, you started in 2009. So you were seeing some pretty bad Warriors teams there that you were covering. And then you saw the incremental success that they had. You saw them reach, you know, whatever ceiling they had with Mark Jackson and then Steve Kerr take that to the next level. And now you're seeing, you know, we didn't think it could get much better than this. And all of a sudden they bring in Kevin Durant this summer. So things can be a little bit difficult and crazy to predict at times, but I'm wondering if you see any kind of corollaries or similarities here in the trajectory that the Trailblazers are on, starting from last season, and where, you know, the Warriors were when you started covering them several years ago.
There definitely are some. The idea of having multiple players that can create offense is something that actually is going to be a change for the Warriors this year. You know, the Lillard and Curry are analogs to a point, but CJ is a much more capable overall offensive player than Klay Thompson. He's not more than KD, but KD wasn't on this team before this year. And so that is a huge starting point. And they, one of the big differences with the Warriors over that time that the Blazers don't have to deal with was just kind of the evolution of figuring a lot of this stuff out. Like Portland, because they had those other vets and they were really successful with LaMarcus and Nick Batum and Robin Lopez and all those guys, like they're a lot of, they've experienced success in a way that the Warriors had to do for themselves, and so that really is a leg up. And the challenge is going to be, so you there are two ways to get better from that point. One is improvement externally, so getting better players and things like that. Then the other one is internal improvements. So that can be maximizing who you have, you know, and then players getting better. And that's where the Blazers need to follow Golden State's model. Is Draymond Green and Stephen Curry have improved more since they became pros than a vast majority of players in NBA history. I mean, it's just something that they've done. They've added more to their games. And Lillard is certainly capable of that. Physically, he's underrated in terms of his athleticism. He's great on ball, great off ball. CJ can work a little bit more with that. And what internal improvement does is it allows you to get better even when your tools to add talent are diminished. And that's what Portland's going to have to do now, because justifiably their players are all worth the contracts they're getting. So their improvement is going to have to be that way, but they certainly can do it.
So Danny, I want to thank you again for coming on. Before we take off here, I want to give you the opportunity to let Blazers Edge listeners know where they can find your work.
Sure. So you can, the easiest way to do it, since I write so many or podcast so many different places, is just to follow me on Twitter at Danny LaRue or Danny LaRue on Facebook. That's LeRoux. And then my writing is mostly at The Sporting News. That's CBA. The Athletic is Warriors, and then everything else is Real GM, who I've been with since 2009. And then podcasting, Locked On Warriors, Real GM Radio, and then the Dunked On podcast with Nate Duncan.
Great. Like I said, thank you very much for coming on, man. We'll have to catch up again soon.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Okay, we're all done with episode 178 of the Blazers Edge podcast. We'd like to thank you very much for joining us this week, and we'd also like to give a huge thank you to Danny LaRue from Sporting News, The Athletic, and a number of other different outlets for coming on the show this week.
Absolutely. And as usual, our intro and outro beats are brought to you by Odar. You can check out his work at soundcloud.com/odarbeats. Be sure to tune into the Blazers Edge midweek podcast with Dave Deckard and Dan Marang, as well as the Fanalists with Tara and Joe. And for Chris Lucia, I am Brandon Goldner. And remember, if it's going to be raining all weekend, well, you might want to invest in an umbrella. Well, I just want to give a shout out to myself.